From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Republicans are still scrambling to pass their massive 500-page tax reform bill within the week and present it to President Donald Trump for signature. After both the House and Senate rushed through their versions of the bill with barely any debate or analysis, last-minute changes are now emerging in the reconciliation process to win over every vote. Bob Corker, who was the only Republican to have voted against the Senate bill, has now declared his support for the bill, but journalists and activists are pointing out that a newly added tax provision on real estate holdings would personally benefit him and other members of Congress. They have started a hashtag Corker kickback on social media, putting some Republicans on the defensive. Also jeopardizing the GOP plan is Senator John McCain, who may miss the vote while in treatment for cancer. And there's still wrangling between the two parties over the seating of newly elected Alabama Democrat Doug Jones, who was expected to vote against the bill if given the chance. Jones has now worried Democrats with an interview where he did not unequivocally slam the bill and instead said he was simply unsure of it. In the meantime, another change that has emerged in the reconciliation process is the nixing of a graduate student loan provision that hundreds of students protested against. Americans have been frantically calling their representatives, and some have been holding sit-ins to block the hugely unpopular tax plan. My guest is Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. He's also a contributor to The Intercept. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, and he's a regular news correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Arun.
Great to be here with you today, Sonali.
So what do you make of the fact that, first of all, Republicans who are scrambling to win every possible vote they can, because the Senate version just passed by one vote, are so sort of overt about the handouts that they're giving, the so-called special interests that they're catering to in order to pass this bill? It doesn't even seem like they're trying to hide it very much.
No, they never have really. And I think what this gets at is one, that they desperately needed a win of any sort. Secondly, the billionaires like the Koch brothers were apparently telling them, if you don't get this done, you will be cut off. And three, what we also know is that there's a large proportion of Donald Trump's base, some polls put about 75%, that there's virtually nothing he can do that would make them lose their support. So there with Trump, this is his, he has fanatical support. They're with him until the bitter end. So for the Republicans, this made sense. And of course, what they're doing is they're completely spinning it or trying to spin it as somehow helping middle America, when a lot of people, tens of million people, are going to see their taxes go up. And on top of that, it's also going to lead to potentially the collapse of Obamacare with the cutting of the individual mandate. So that's going to hurt an estimated 13 million people who lose their insurance over the next decade.
How much activism do you think there is against this bill? I mean, I feel like everyone I know has been making phone calls against it, but we aren't seeing as many instances of street actions, of actual sit-ins, as we did say against the potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act, the health reform effort. Is that primarily because there might not be as clear an understanding of what this bill does, and or because it's being done so fast, people hadn't had a time to actually organize things?
I think that's part of it. I think also there's simply exhaustion. You know, it was clear that Donald Trump's strategy from the beginning has been to just throw so much stuff at the fan that people just get exhausted by protesting. I mean, there are outrages every day. You know, we saw the repeal of net neutrality last week, the banned words at the Centers for disease control. Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, is trying to start a war with Iran. So it's just this constant barrage of atrocities, essentially, coming from this administration. Then there is the difficulty of understanding the tax bill. But I think there's also a certain level of futility that who are you trying to sway? You know, it's these right-wing senators who are called moderates, you know, but who are pretty extreme. Let's remember, you know, that John McCain has a really far-right record. He's never met a war he doesn't like, and he always votes for these huge giveaways to the rich. And so these are the people.
People thought because he voted against the health reform bill that he was now somehow going to change sides.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, apparently his real beef with that was the process. And so, you know, the Republicans, they had, I think, about three different failures with the health care bill, trying to get it through Congress. And so they learned, you know, what they had to do. And in the end, they end up larding it with these insane tax giveaways, not just to the rich, but to their own members, like to Corker, like to Trump himself. By one estimate, 13 senior Republicans who are involved in drafting this tax bill are going to get giveaways of millions of dollars through this provision that was slipped in at the last minute about real estate holdings.
And actually, let's fixate on that for just a tiny minute. It is making some waves in at least social media. Journalist David Sirota and others for the International Business Times exposed this, that Senator Bob Corker might have had his mind changed because he has a lot of real estate holdings and would personally benefit from this change that was put in place. And they've started hashtag Corker kickback that has actually gotten some Corker himself saying, no, that has nothing to do with it. But it must have lots to do with it if this only emerged during the reconciliation process.
Yeah, Corker is estimated to be worth $70 million. He started in construction and then became a real estate mogul in Tennessee. Donald Trump and the family, of course, are worth hundreds of millions, if not well over a billion dollars. And this is basically an obscure provision that allows pass-through money deductions for that. So for someone like Donald Trump, this can be worth tens of millions of dollars a year. But I think this whole bill points to a deeper problem. You know, there are times where I honestly feel like America is going insane. Basically, you have a significant part of the population that is completely beholden to an alternate reality. You have Fox News that is just complete propaganda and lies. You know, if you tune in Fox News, everything is going great in America. You know, jobs are coming back. Terrorism is being defeated. The economy is roaring, when none of this is really true, that, you know, we are still limping into the 10th year after the Great Recession, and wages are still depressed. 100 million people are essentially living in poverty or near poverty, and people are stressed by rent and health care costs. But people, there is this phenomena on the right wing that people believe in this alternate reality, and it's become very hard to shake, especially when we have such a terrible education system in this country, the propaganda, and I think also just the echo chambers of social media.
So despite this misinformation, there is something like 70% of Americans polled are against this bill, and I'm wondering if the reality of it were better understood, that might not be 90 or 95%. So, you know, the Republicans have been able to make very wild claims about how individual Americans might be getting big tax breaks. You know, what would this family do with an extra $400 a year, without mentioning that they probably will owe more taxes because of other loopholes or other issues in the bill? And so this sort of they've been able to get away with this because their echo chamber lets them. And so I'm wondering if even the tiny bit of support there is for this bill, or maybe one might see it as somewhat complacence or activism fatigue, is because some people subconsciously think, well, maybe I, even if corporations are going to get massive tax breaks, even if the rich are going to get richer, maybe I will get a few hundred dollars back next year and I could really use that.
Yes, that and also I think people are so desperate in this economy that they cling on to a misguided belief in the trickle-down economy. Well, maybe there will be more spending that will create more jobs. You know, the reality is also is that because Wall Street is expecting to have this massive binge. You know, the stock market has been soaring all year, and it's likely to keep soaring because that's what's going to happen with these tax cuts and repatriation of foreign profits. Is there going to be sunk into stock buyback plans, which will send the economy soaring even more? And that does create, it's basically sugar rush economics. It does create a bit of a knock-on effect. And you know, to be honest, before we also just blame Trump supporters as dupes, I think there is a brutal reality that for a lot of organized labor, they see their whatever future they have as reproduced through corporations. In other words, that they can only keep going in the healthcare industry and the service sector industry if the corporations are doing well. So it's not entirely surprising that a lot of the American public would identify with corporations to one degree. And when we're saying that 70% oppose it and 30% support it, that matches up pretty closely also with Donald Trump's approval rating. So, and unfortunately, like I said, none of this is really a surprise.
Well, some of the folks who have been putting their bodies on the line despite a year of very, very difficult work were members of the clergy that had a sit-in at Senator Susan Collins's office in Maine, Portland, Maine. And she was one of the two sort of moderate Republicans we were referring to earlier, or people seen as moderate Republicans who voted against the health reform bill and helped to kill that. But Susan Collins is now throwing her weight behind the tax bill. And a number of these folks had a sit-in and were arrested. Their activism was covered briefly in the major media, but unfortunately didn't seem to make much practical difference.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the problems of the moment we're in, and this was the same with the Bush era, is who ends up looking good because the politics have become so extreme right wing. So over the last year, we've seen people like Mueller, you know, the head of the FBI, an agency that is
Right.
essentially historically its role has been to crush political dissent. You know, he's now this liberal darling, or you know, the generals in the White House, these crazy right-wing and racist generals like Kelly, you know, who a few months ago said Mexico was on the verge of collapse, who was enforcing these really gung-ho to enforce really racist border policies. He is the adult in the room. You know, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, 40, 50 years ago, these guys would have been considered extremists in the political spectrum. Now they're considered the noble moderates who are going to stand up to Trump. Or, you know, people like Corker, who's obviously willing to sell his vote out for a little personal booty. Susan Collins, who keeps claiming that she got an agreement, which is absurd. You know, Donald Trump never stands on anything that he promises. He'll undercut it immediately. And he hasn't given any public promises. We also have a pretty feckless Democratic resistance. You know, they sold out the immigrant dreamers, And while I think people should celebrate the defeat of Roy Moore in Alabama, they also see what they get when someone like Doug Jones, who is at least making noise about willing to side with the
So
Republicans.
let's actually stay on those two issues very briefly. They're worth looking at. The Democrats had said on the budget process that was running parallel to the tax reform effort that they would not cave to Republican demands unless they got a deal on DACA or some sort of legislative process started, DREAM Act, extension of DACA, et cetera. You're saying now that they have essentially keeled over and said, all right, we're going to give up on that.
Well, first of all, they could have forced something back in September when Trump needed a budget agreement, and Schumer and Pelosi punted on finding a solution for the 800,000 youth who came in who have been semi-legalized through the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And now they're saying that they're not going to have a government shutdown over this. And frankly, if you're not willing to basically go to the mat on this one, then the Republicans are going to roll you. If they do get a deal, it's likely to come with so much border enforcement and money, perhaps some money for a wall, as well as all sorts of new powers for internal enforcement and deportations. It's just going to be a pyrrhic victory in the end, even if they do get anything.
So is it that they sort of saw the writing on the wall and backed off, or just simply weren't willing to go as far as Republicans who will, fight tooth and nail regardless of the consequences for things that they want to achieve?
Yeah, I think they just have absolutely no backbone whatsoever. To be, fair, it is a risk. When we saw the Republican shutdowns under Obama, it did backfire on them. But at the same time, they were shutting down the government for unprincipled reasons. This time it would be shutting the government down for a very principled reason. And we know that the backbench of the Democratic Party is eager and willing to have a shutdown over this issue. If you can't save 800,000 youth, then what good are these powers? But Schumer and Pelosi are very much trying to play for the middle. If we remember, after the tax bill initially passed the Senate, what did Chuck Schumer tweet about? It wasn't about how horrendous this bill was, that it was a giveaway to the rich, that it was going to gut Obamacare. It was, why can't we have more partisanship, bipartisanship? That's what he was whining about, as if bipartisanship is any sort of solution. In fact, there's an argument that there was too much bipartisanship during the Bush era, such as the approval of the Patriot Act, the approval of the Bush tax cuts, the authorization for use of military force. The last thing we need is bipartisanship with extremism.
So then let's talk about the other aspect of the Democrats, which is that they, and actually a lot of progressive activists, grassroots organizations, poured effort into defeating Roy Moore in Alabama so that Doug Jones could be the senator. And in many ways, this seems as though, and I wrote an article about this for Truthdig last week, it felt like what happened in Alabama was a sort of redo at the state level of last year's presidential race, where you had this incredible sort of predatory liar fanatic on one side and then a kind of milquetoast centrist Democrat on the other side. And the radical one in Alabama, you had the flip result, but by a razor-thin margin. And now Doug Jones seems like he might actually be a friend to Republicans rather than to Democrats. So was this all a wasted effort, or should we celebrate the fact that a person like Roy Moore, by a small margin, has managed to stay out of the Senate?
Well, I think, you know, we should historicize what's going on. I mean, most important, Roy Moore is still the senator from Alabama. And Alabama is basically the Taliban of the United States.
So you're saying Doug Jones is the best that Alabama could do?
Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is you had almost 80% of white working class men voting for a neo-Confederate pedophile who thought everything was peachy keen when slavery was around. That just shows how extreme the political culture is there. So I don't make too much of that. I think that the fact that Doug Jones says, you know, first of all, he was just making some noise on the talk shows, and it may play well back home. But I think in the end, you'll see him on all the big issues siding with the Democratic caucus. I think the more important point is this is what happens when you get a Republican in the White House. You know, a year ago, when before the 2016 election, when we were talking about this, I was one of the few reporters on the left who was out there covering the presidential campaign, and all the other leftist reporters. We were all warning about the same thing, that Donald Trump is this extreme threat. He needs to be stopped at all costs. And yet you've had a lot of the left. Now, hindsight is 2020, and we don't know if Trump could have been stopped. But nonetheless, you had a lot of people on the left, a lot of obviously Green Party supporters who were out there like Clinton is as bad as Trump, or even Clinton is worse than Trump. And the problem is when you have an extremist like Trump, like Bush, like Ronald Reagan, like Nixon in the White House, you get partisan movements. All the energy goes into ousting those presidents, into trying to flip Congress, into trying to change the makeup of state legislatures, the government mansion, governor's mansions. And that's where we're going to see all this organizing energy going into. If we go back to the summer of 2016, other than the elections, what was being talked about? People were talking about Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives. They were talking about the climate justice movement, the pipeline blockades. They were talking about the low-wage workers movement, Fight for 15. We were also talking about Dreamers and immigrant rights. And now all of these movements have basically been suppressed or they're severely on the defensive. You know, we've gone from Black Lives Matter to Black identity extremists. Now, instead of expanding DACA and also pushing back the deportations, while they did reach a peak under Obama early on, by the end of his term, they had dropped by 75%. So there was progress that was being made. And now we've seen also, you know, just disastrous moves made in terms of climate, the approval of the DAPL and KXL pipelines, and on and on and on. Essentially, I think those leftists out there who were saying Clinton was as bad or the same as Trump made a huge and tragic historical mistake that we're going to be paying for a long time.
So what you're saying is Hillary Clinton and Doug Jones are the enemies that we want to have, not
exactly.
Donald Trump and Roy Moore. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm glad you remember that line. Yeah, I was saying that a year ago. Hillary Clinton was the enemy the left needs.
Yeah.
And it was obvious. You know, we wouldn't see these banned words at the CDC. You know, we're likely going to see the gutting of public sector unions. This is just this is a battle that took decades to won and has been in force for 50 years, the unionization of government employees. And there's a Supreme Court decision, Janus, that is likely to come down that'll make public sectors a right to work. And this is just going to be have terrible consequences.
So in the last few minutes of our conversation, Arun, I want to focus on a couple of things. One is that on the tax bill, which is what we started talking about, graduate students seem to have scored a victory. There was a provision in the Senate version of the bill where graduate students would essentially have been taxed on the amount that they didn't have to pay to go to school, which is basically going to be treated as income. The tuition waivers that they got would have been treated as income, and they would have been left with these huge tax bills. And a lot of graduate students did mobilize. They mobilized on social media. They mobilized in person. That provision, as far as I understand now, has been taken out of the bill. That is a pretty big victory, and at least this one's narrow constituency acted and won.
Yeah, I would also suspect that a lot of it had to do with university presidents. You know, there's over 100 educational institutions in this country with endowments of over $1 billion, and they get huge support from the 0.01%, from billionaires, from corporations. And I have no doubt that they mobilize behind the scenes to influence Congress. That's not to say that the graduate students didn't play an important role. But, you know, as we've seen in Wisconsin, Scott Walker has gutted this great institution of higher education, the University of Wisconsin, just out of pure vindictiveness. I mean, this is going to hurt the state for decades to come when you're cutting, savaging its premier educational institution. And there was also a poll that came out recently, something like over 70% of Republicans have a negative attitude of colleges and universities. I mean, that's how extremist this country has become, that people hate higher education, they hate public, they hate school teachers. So, you know, while the graduate students, I think, you know, what they did was great, I think there's more to the story than that.
Well, then finally, Arun, next year, January 20th, will be the first anniversary of the Women's March, which took place the day before Donald Trump's inauguration. There has been a version 2.0 announced, another march to be taking place on the same day in cities around the country. That moment was a bright spot. You know, January 20th, 2017 was a bright spot in what had been a few months of sort of collective depression and anxiety after the election results. But this past year has kind of shown that everything that we feared and then some has come true. What do you make of the plans for the next march? Do you think it will be bigger? Do you think it'll make any difference? Are you planning on attending? Your just general thoughts on it.
Yeah, I'm planning on attending. One, I don't think it's going to be bigger. The march is last year. I think also they were the day after the inauguration, were extraordinarily huge. They're some of the biggest I've ever seen in my life, bigger than the anti-Iraq war marches. And secondly, this energy is going to go into the 2018 elections. You know, it's likely to be the year of women on steroids. That's a reference to the 1992 elections that saw, I think, six Democratic women enter the U.S. Senate. With the Me Too movement, you're seeing a lot of women running, you know, and also one of the positive effects of Doug Jones' victory, the fact that they were able to win in Alabama, albeit against a pedophile, shows how much people in the center are turning against Donald Trump. And so you're seeing the Democrats being able to recruit strong candidates in House races across the country. And a lot of them are women. And so this is, I think, where you're going to see the energy go. This is, again, the unfortunate reality. Rather than movement building, this energy is going to go into the Democratic Party. And while, you know, there needs to be some sort of check on Trump, it's not the type of movement building that we need.
And you are right. It was the day after the inauguration. The inauguration was on January 20th. The march was on the 21st. So thanks for that correction. Well, Arun, I want to thank you as always for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on, Sonali.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, and Raw Story. He's also a contributor to The Intercept. His forthcoming book is called Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction. He's a regular news correspondent for our program. We've been discussing the latest GOP efforts to pass its tax plan, as well as activist efforts to derail it. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do find us also on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.